At the same time, it must be indicated that the soil of Imam al-Hussein's burial place has some protective value because, for example, in the conduct of the 8th infallible Imam Ali ibn Musa al-Ridha alayhi salam, when he wanted to guarantee a safe journey for a close companion, Imam al-Ridha alayhi salam, used to give the person, the traveler, just a little, amount of the soil of Imam al-Hussein's burial place.
That's right.
And it was, it guaranteed everything.
It's better to say that the holy body of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, which is buried over there, has affected the soil in which he's buried.
Yes.
And because of his divine character and the divinity and the light, we can say the soil is also influenced over there. And this made the soil to be of
blessed,
influence.
Especially blessed.
And especially blessed by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to the people who are after, for example, healing or the barakah of the soil. So if the body of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam is blessed with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, its holiness can be transferred to the soul too.
Yes, let me say something.
Okay.
In the book Kamil al-Ziyarat, there's a piece of hadith from the 6th infallible Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq alayhi salam. In it, he said in this way, مَوْضَ غَبْرُ الْحُسَيْنِ مَنْ ذَيَوْمَنْ دُفَنَ فِي رَوْضَةً مِنْ رِيَاضِ الْجَنَّةِ. The burial place of Imam al-Hussein al-Islam, since the day he was buried over there, has turned into a paradise garden, or a garden among the paradise gardens. Okay,
yes.
It indicates that the place has been specially blessed, not consecrated, but specially blessed, because of the sacred body of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam.
Also in Ziyarat al-Nahiyat al-Muqaddasa by Imam Mahdi, we have, O Hussein, peace be upon you, whose soil of tomb is the healing.
Yes.
Okay?
Yes, this has the healing power.
Yes, has the healing power. Okay, Sheikh Matavi, let's get to you, brother. Maybe we can say this is intangible for some of our dear listeners. What is still you are talking about the healing power of a piece of soil. Can you give us some other, for example, details regarding this topic that was compiled by Mirza Awal Mawliya Kalbasi in a book, in a separate book, and it's really outstanding.
Regarding the point that you mentioned, that it might seem strange to our listeners how a iota of soil could have a kind of healing power. I think this is very good for them to know that healing power is something which is going to be granted by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, no matter what is that substance or item, no matter if it is a piece of fabric, the clothes of Prophet Yusuf, which is going to heal the eyesight of his father.
Yeah, this is mentioned in the Quran.
Yes.
Yes.
Or it is going to be put in a piece of wood, which is a tabut, the cradle of Prophet Musa. As we see, its power has been mentioned in the Quran, how it's going to bring tranquility for the Bani Israel. So we see such powers could be given or could be put into whatsoever item that Allah wishes. So a iota of a soil or a piece of a soil could be taken as that item as well. That's why we see in the narrations of the Imams that thing has been mentioned, that this healing power has been put in the soil of the grave or the area around the grave of Imam Hussein, that this is actually one of the subtopics that Allama Kalbasi is going to talk about in his book.
Right.
When we go to the content, to the table of the content, we see one of the things he talks about after giving some points regarding the ban of taking clay or soil. And then he talks about the area in which if you take that soil, it is going to be regarded the healing soil. Because we know that place that Imam Hussein has been buried is not the same place today people are going for the pilgrimage. It is actually regarded almost 10 meters below.
Is it, Dr. Fakhruhani, the place that Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, the exact grave site, is very much lower than the chamber people are visiting, is it?
Yes.
How meter is it? I mean, how long? 10 meters? 20 meters?
Yes, around 10 meters.
10 meters lower, okay?
Yes.
And that is the exact burial place of Imam al-Hussein
Al-Hassan
al-Ali
al-Akbar,
okay?
Yes.
And the people are not allowed to visit over there?
No, never.
Okay.
Special people. Only special people for on certain missions.
That are
directed there.
Okay.
Yes.
So that's why he's talking about this topic, that which place is regarded Harim al-Qabr, or the place in which if you take dust from, that's going to be healing, or it will have that healing power. And then he talks about the conditions that must be met in order to get that healing power, and then Sharaat al-Istishfa and the rest. I mean, the rest of the topics that he's going to talk about, and even different functions of this torba that have been narrated or have been mentioned in the narrations and sayings of the Imam. It is not only for the sick to get and then get cured. Even they are saying that the moment of the delivering the child, the first thing he has to take is part of the torba. The moment of burial, when they are going to put the dead corpse of the person into the grave. All those detailed points that today we are not going to talk about.
Okay.
So that is a kind of comprehensive book regarding the healing power of the soil of Imam Hussein, actually the grave of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, and its different functions besides that.
One of which is, for example, the torba that the Shias, for example, put on the foreheads when doing salat, isn't it?
Yeah, that is.
As a sample, of course, this torba might not be the original one, but this is, as we can say, the sign of respect for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, and showing that when your forehead on the dust, you are submissive to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the total respect and being as a true servant. Okay, Dr. Fakhwani, anything missed about the torba of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam? Any story, any important event, or any, for example... because really, this is an interesting topic. Usually the public ask about, for example, the sharaat, the conditions in which the torba might be consumed, or what are the etiquettes, in fact, how to respect this torba.
Yes, it must be indicated that in Shia Husseini literature, there are some conditions for the use of Torbat al-Hussein, the soil of Imam al-Hussein's burial place. However, and in addition to what's already been covered here, I should like to point out to something else. In India, I mean, to my experience in India, there are some places in some cities in India which are called Karbala. For example, there's a place in New Delhi which is called Karbala. Also, the same Karbala can be found in Hyderabad.
Okay. And what is it?
But yes, what's the significance?
Okay? Yes.
Pious Muslims and pious Shias, and some of them, for example, in the case of New Delhi, I heard that the man who gave his personal piece of land to a place to be called Karbala was an Indian, was a Hindu.
Yes.
And when he found out that his son was going to die because of an unknown illness or perhaps cancer, someone suggested him to make use of just a small iota of, Torbat al-Hussein. And his son, was healed, was recovered. In effect of this, this Hindu became Shia and devoted a large piece of land of his property to Karbala Ali Ganj. But, and he himself changed his name from a Hindu name into Ali.
Okay.
And the place is known as Karbala Ali Ganj.
Okay.
Ali Ganj Karbala.
Yes, very
but
good.
Moreover, in order to add blessing to the same piece of land, he imported just some small pieces of soil from Karbala and spread the dust of Karbala over the whole region. The same was done in Hyderabad.
Okay? Very beautiful.
So we find that places in not located in Shia heartlands, some pieces of lands carry the name Karbala because of
are
having received
with, yes.
some soils from Karbala.
And they are blessed.
Yes, they are blessed.
Blessed.
Yes,
okay.
Yes.
When a Shia child is born, we can't say his mouth is blessed with the soil of Karbala. The land is blessed.
Yes.
That's all right. The tasbih, the rosaries are blessed, with the soil of Karbala. And we say this is not simple. It needs a believer. It needs, for example, some different conditions to consume and to be effective. Really, really interesting topic. We can say which was tackled by Mirza Abul Mawali Kalbasi in his book Al Istishwa, but Turbat al Sharifat al Husayniya, really outstanding work. Thank you much, Dr. Fakhwani.
Welcome.
And Sheikh Mahdavi for a nice elaboration regarding this topic. It was very kind of you. About Sheikh Mirza Abul Mawali Kalbasi, Safar 27th, 1315, he passed away at the age of 67. In the city of Isfahan, and he was buried, we can say, around the Taht-e-Fulat Cemetery, which is the burial place of so many outstanding Muslim scholars in the city of Isfahan. And today, Takiyeh Kalbasi, which is the burial place of so many members of this family, is over there with the domes, with the brick domes over there in the Taht-e-Fulat Cemetery in the city of Isfahan. May Allah bless the soul of Mirza Abul Mawali Kalbasi, the author of Al Istishfa wa Turbat al Sharifat al Husayniya. And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/Ian Call of Islam page. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
A diverse range of programs, spirituality, youth, Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Oil and gas, two commodities that have been at the center of news for months now, mainly due to the conflict in Ukraine. One of the criticisms leveled against these oil and gas giants are the record profits that they are raking in.
It is immoral for oil and gas companies to be making record profits from this energy crisis on the back of the poorest people and communities and at a massive cost to the climate.
Bombshell report, however, is putting the spotlight more on these oil companies, but for the wrong reasons. Like this headline, criticism intensifies after big oil admits gaslighting public over green aims, which goes on to say, fury as explosive files reveal largest oil companies contradicted public statements and wished bedbugs upon critical activists, like this one.
And here today, we're going to be out demanding that the City of London, which is responsible or oversees about 15% of fossil fuel funding, could actually very, very rapidly, you know, get this source of finance switched off and move towards a green economy.
Here are the opening statements of the Oversight Committee.
Today we are holding our third hearing in the committee's investigation into the fossil fuel industry's decades-long climate disinformation and greenwashing campaigns.
big oil, namely ExxonMobil, Chevron, Shell, and BP, are at the center of controversy again and yet again, lying about keeping in line with climate change restrictions.
But these executives refused to commit to real changes.
What kind of lies? Here's one example.
But it is more than having to change. We want to change. We want to change because it's the right thing for the world, and it's a tremendous business opportunity for BP.
It was not too long ago when these headlines and pictures were plastered on the front pages of newspapers around the world. Climate change alarm, code red for humanity. Yet these alarm bells fail to stop these big oil companies from advancing their agenda, making money at the expense of people for their shareholders. While these companies are making record profits, it is worth noting the economic costs of climate change. The global cost of adapting to the climate impacts is expected to grow $140 to $300 billion per year by the year 2030 and $280 to $500 billion per year by the year 2050. To get the full impact of what these energy conglomerates are doing, the bare facts need to be known. According to a report published by the Carbon Majors Database in 2017, just 100 of them have been the source of more than 70% of the world's greenhouse gas emissions since the year 1988. If fossil fuels continue to be extracted at the same rate over the next 28 years as they were between 1988 and 2017, global temperatures would rise by 4 degrees Celsius by the end of the century. What is shocking is that these large corporations like Exxon knew about climate change almost 50 years ago. In 2015, it was revealed that Exxon understood the science before it became a public issue. It was called the Climate Deception Dossiers.
The reality of global warming began making front-page headlines nearly 30 years ago. That's when the world's largest fossil fuel companies launched a three-decade campaign to deceive the public and delay action on climate change.
The worst part about these findings was that ExxonMobil spent millions of dollars to promote misinformation about the issue. The goal? To sow doubt about climate change. Let that sink in. Because these dossiers revealed that the coalition of fossil fuel companies had launched a big communications effort to sow doubt. Their motto, victory will be achieved when the average person is uncertain about climate science. Then in 2019, it was reported that major global firms were accused of concealing their environmental impact. This included more than 700 companies like Facebook, Amazon, Tesco, and here we go again, ExxonMobil. They were accused of lacking transparency over things like water shortages and deforestation. How these non-oil and gas companies do this is that they do what's called greenwashing, conveying a false impression that one's products are environmentally friendly or sound, when in essence they are not. And here are some of the companies that are guilty of this. Famous brands known the world over, claiming that they have gone green, but in essence they have not. Whether it was the Paris Climate Accord or COP26.
And we arrive at what I believe is the moment of truth.
Or John Kerry.
It is time to come together for future generations in ways that none of us really ever thought we might have an opportunity to do.
All of that appears to be on the shelf for now. With a lack of energy resources, European countries and the U.S. are scrambling to fill the shortages, even if it includes resorting to big CO2 emitters like fossil fuels. On the surface, This is legislation that the U.S. is passing through Congress to, in short, stop African countries from associating with Russia, especially when it comes to business activities. But looking deeper, this is what many call the U.S. bullying other countries into submission. That is how the South African president is viewing this, urging the U.S. to not punish African nations by pressuring them to cut ties with Moscow. Cyril Ramaphosa realizes the dangers behind this legislation. He has said that this measure will harm Africa and marginalize the continent. We should not be told by anyone who we can associate with. When it comes to Russia, many African countries feel the same. For example, when a UN voting took place for sanctions to be imposed on Russia, 17 African countries abstained from the UN vote. The U.S. Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, had to come out and defend U.S. interests in Africa, stating that U.S. intentions are not to dictate what African nations should do.
Too often, African nations have been treated as instruments of other nations' progress rather than the authors of their own. Time and again, they have been told to pick a side in great power contests that feel far removed from daily struggles of their people. The United States will not dictate Africa's choices. Neither should anyone else.
The source of this aggressive U.S. legislation dates back years ago. During the tenure of the former U.S. President Donald Trump, the U.S. unveiled a new Africa policy to counter what it called predatory Russia and China. This was unveiled by the former U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton, who said that the U.S. was losing ground to China and Russia.
The predatory practices pursued by China and Russia stunt economic growth in Africa, threaten the financial independence of African nations, inhibit opportunities for U.S. investment, interfere with U.S. military operations, and pose a significant threat to U.S. national security interests.
Yet Bolton was not forthright in the U.S. policy on Africa. He failed to mention that the U.S. had limited resources to compete with the tens of billions of dollars that China was pouring into Africa. And on the predatory practices of China and Russia that set up debt traps, that just didn't hold ground. Take this piece of news, the fact that China canceled 23 loans to African countries. This silenced the critics that accused Beijing of practicing debt trap diplomacy, that it deliberately lent money to countries that it knows cannot repay the money, with the goal of increasing its political leverage. Meanwhile, the U.S. has fallen out of favor with many African countries. One survey found that 76% of young Africans named China as the foreign power with a positive influence on their lives. When it comes to Russia, the U.S. has accused it of selling arms in exchange for votes at the U.N. Those votes, he added, helped keep strongmen in power, undermined peace and security, and ran counter to the best interests of the African people. Well, if that is the case, then what about the U.S. keeping strongmen in power in monarchies in the Persian Gulf, regimes like Saudi Arabia or Bahrain? South Africa's foreign minister, Naledi Pandor, holds the same view as the South African president when it comes to Russia. She referenced the Soviet Union's championing of anti-apartheid forces compared with Western cooperation with South Africa's former white supremacist regime. The U.S. Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, had to come out and defend U.S. interests in Africa, stating that U.S. intentions are not to dictate what African nations should do.
What we seek most of all is a true partnership between the United States and Africa. We don't want an imbalanced or transactional relationship. And our commitment to a stronger partnership with Africa is not about trying to outdo anyone else.
Successive U.S. administrations have tried to penetrate the African political and economic landscape, but it looks like their efforts have not succeeded, lagging one step behind other powers like China and Russia. The Ukraine conflict is clear proof of that. This is one of the occasions that many nations have been reluctant to embrace the West in its campaign to pressure Moscow. But that is not the only time that a considerable portion of an entire continent does not give importance to U.S. pressure. Recently, snubs from key leaders at the Summit of the Americas revealed U.S. President Joe Biden's struggle to assert U.S. leadership in its neighborhood. The issue of U.S. leadership being questioned begs the question, where else is the U.S. leadership under doubt? From Latin America to Africa to West Asia, all the way to Asia and China in particular, the U.S. is losing support from countries around the world. That is why the phrase, the U.S. losing its superpower status, continues to reverberate in many countries. But perhaps one of the tools that the U.S. uses, which has had a strong backlash, making it fall out of favor with many countries, is the use of sanctions and the use of the dollar as a weapon. Many countries view this as a form of bullying for countries to follow U.S. foreign policy, which is probably why the South African president has said, we should not be told by anyone who we can associate with. It was a massacre that was unprecedented, and it highlighted how private U.S. military contractors felt that they were above the law. 15 years ago, these military contractors shot and killed 17 Iraqis, including 2 children. The massacre, which became known as the Nisour Square Massacre, highlighted what can go wrong when private military contractors are used, especially when it comes to accountability.
We strive for perfection. We try to drive towards the highest standards, but the fog of war and accidents and the bad guys just have to get lucky once.
The U.S. used private military contractors heavily in Iraq and in Afghanistan. Now the new theater of war is Ukraine. Here is an ad for hiring these contractors. Wanted, multilingual former soldiers willing to covertly head into Ukraine for the handsome sum of up to $2,000 per day. Yes, demand is soaring, and there are plenty of people who are signing up. But what are they called? Contractors? Volunteers? Mercenaries? Or paid security workers? Obviously, some are former soldiers with the ability to fight and kill. This leaves plenty of room for mistakes, meaning civilian casualties. Remember when Ukraine's president made this announcement? Zelensky reveals the number of foreign volunteers for Ukraine, the first of some 16,000 fighters to have already arrived, the Ukrainian president said. He further added, Ukraine continues to receive weaponry on a daily basis from our partners, from real friends. And the weapons are more and more powerful every day. The very same weapons that are given to these volunteers. So far, the number of so-called volunteers to have joined the Ukrainian armed forces could be as high as 20,000, a figure that could even exceed that. The demographics of these fighters are varied. In all, fighters from Eastern Europe and former Soviet republics constitute the majority of fighters. In terms of Western countries, the greatest number of foreign fighters include the U.S., U.K., Canada, Germany, France, and even some that are coming from Japan. When it comes to the U.S. private military contractors, the one that stands out is Academy, formerly known as Blackwater. Reports have pointed to its involvement in Ukraine. First, reports emerged in July 2021 that Blackwater founder Eric Prince had plans to create a $10 billion private army in Ukraine. His plans included a private army staff by former Ukrainian combat veterans. However, what is not widely reported was that Academy was involved in Ukraine already since the year 2014. Hundreds of these mercenaries were operating in the country's east and south, but the U.S. has denied these claims. But other Western countries are open in their admission of foreign fighters fighting in Ukraine. Take Germany, for example. Germany's Foreign Office tweet is very telling here. Reports on death sentences against foreign nationals serving in Ukraine's armed forces are shocking. As combatants, they are prisoners of war, entitled to special protections under the Geneva Convention. The UK's involvement has been heavy when it comes to foreign fighters. In June, it was reported how the UK has training centers set up for Ukrainian recruits to train soldiers sent by Kiev, including women, for urban combat. The target for the number of people that the UK can train, 10,000 soldiers every 3 months. Whether they are private military contractors, volunteers, or whatever name they are called, they're fueling the flames of war. It should be mentioned that Russia is also complicit in its use of contractors or mercenaries as well, as it has been reported. The extent and the number, however, is not known. Let's not forget, it wasn't too long ago that the armed groups in Syria were getting help from America, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Turkey. and a source of training for the armed gangs was the notorious U.S. private security firm formerly known as Blackwater. Security circles have long reported that it was sending mercenaries from Iraq into Syria, something which the U.S. stands accused of until this day. Ukraine is becoming eerily similar to Syria, thanks to the U.S. and its European partners, who are keen to make sure that this war continues, from the massive military aid to manpower in the form of these contractors. Pumping Ukraine with weapons has become the main trend for the U.S., leading the Europeans down the same path. So high the volume of these weapons that Ukrainian illegal arms trafficking has become a terrorist threat at an international level. This is just another outcome of the wrong and deadly U.S. foreign policy, in which many Iraqis witnessed 15 years ago, as was the case in the Nusayr Square massacre. The conflict between Azerbaijan and Armenia after a truce has blown up again. About 100 soldiers have died in total. This is the worst fighting between the two since the 2020 war. According to Azerbaijan's president, Ilham Aliyev, provocations committed by Armenian forces at the border have been averted and all necessary objectives were fulfilled. It blamed Armenia for the flare-up. It is widely reported that this conflict is due to the dispute over Nagorno-Karabakh region, in which two wars have been fought between the former Soviet republics of Armenia and Azerbaijan. A quick history check reveals how ethnic Armenian separatists in Nagorno-Karabakh first broke away from Azerbaijan when the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991. The war that broke out afterwards claimed the lives of around 30,000 people. Back in 2020, when another war broke out, which lasted 6 weeks, 6,500 lives were lost. The fighting ended with a Russian-brokered ceasefire. Moscow deployed thousands of peacekeepers in the region to successfully mediate to prevent the war from continuing. The question is, what is behind the most recent flare-up? Azerbaijan needs access to bodies of water in order to provide energy resources to the West, which, given its relationship with Iran, Israel and Western entities would prevent that from happening. Azerbaijan's last 2 years of military action against Armenia is to cut and separate the land route between Iran and Armenia and the direct access to Nakhchivan from the southern area of Siunak or Zangezur Corridor, a concept for a transport corridor which, if implemented, would give Azerbaijan unimpeded access to Nakhchivan. Meanwhile, Israel, the U.S., Russia, and Turkey do have a hand either directly or indirectly in this conflict, all for their own political objectives. Israel is a supporter of Azerbaijan, and as such has strengthened its relationship, especially when it comes to military equipment like drones. This to have a front against Iran. Meanwhile, Iran has always had a diplomatic approach to the conflict. During the past war, it was very telling what Iran said, that renewed fighting between its neighbors, Azerbaijan and Armenia, could escalate into a wider regional war. And this is where the U.S. may have motives behind seeing a renewed conflict. One intention may be to draw Russia into this war in order to weaken its capabilities in the Ukraine conflict. And the U.S. certainly does not mind if Iran's borders are destabilized, leaving that task to its watchdog in the region, namely Israel. The U.S., however, is presenting another side to this provocation. The U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken has said that Russia may have a hand in this conflict, stirring the pot in order to distract from Russia's most recent losses in Ukraine, according to the U.S. point of view.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, Signs of Justice. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the signs of justice in the Islamic lifestyle. When we look at the topic of justice and we see that Islam is emphasizing on justice, therefore we need to look at the signs as well that what are the signs? When can we say that a person is observing justice? Because we have different meanings of justice. Some people in today's world, especially those are following the capitalism and the socialism, they have made their own definition of justice. And whatever is in their own favor, they call it justice. And if anything goes against them, they don't call it as justice, and they call it as something which is unfair. But we see that Imam Ali alayhi salam, when he had made different governors and he sent them to different states, he has basically advised them and told them about the signs of someone who wants to observe justice, where he is at the place where he's ruling over the people, or he's a governor or the minister of a state, how he should. And there we see that Imam Ali has said, وَخْفِزْ لِلْرَعِيَّةِ جَنَاحَكَ, that whenever you're in front of people, you must be humble. You must be someone whose eyes are basically dropped down. And even when he lifts his eyes up, he do it with the fairness, that he does not look at one person and maybe he's ignoring the other. So he does not ignore the others. So he looks at everyone equally, so that no one thinks that maybe he has ignored that person, or maybe the other person is more favorable, or maybe he's more closer than him. Therefore, this is the first sign which Imam Ali has said, that if a person is at a state of governorship and he wants to observe the justice, he must look at everyone fairly so that no one thinks badly. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of justice and the signs of justice. Therefore, the first sign which we said is that whenever a person looks at others, he looks fairly so that no one feels bad. The second thing is whenever he says salam to the people, to a group, he meets everyone in the same way. In the same way, so that no one feels bad or maybe having a bad feeling about the person. And whenever he meets those people who have influence in the society, maybe there are investors, maybe there are politicians, maybe there are other people who have influence on the people, or maybe they are at this position, when he sees them in an equal way, so that the others who do not have any status or position, they don't feel bad about it. They don't feel that he's gonna give a favor to these people only, and this person's gonna ignore us, because the one who does not have any reference, maybe there is a person who is in need, he wants a help, but he does not know anyone, he does not have any reference, he does not know any person, or maybe he does not have money. So when you see them, you meet them in a good way, so that they feel secure when they're seeing you, so they feel that you have warmly welcomed them when they're coming to you, you're listening to them with the attention. And this is what we need to look for, because when we are socializing with the people, and especially when we are at a place, for example, someone is a manager, or maybe he's a supervisor or responsible for something. Therefore, whenever he's meeting others, he should meet them in a way that no one feels bad. No one feels that he's giving a specific favor to someone else. And everyone should feel that he is equally dealing with everyone. And this is what Islam is emphasizing on, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
In the limelight.
Though the Western media ignores Sabra and Shatila massacre by the Zionist regime years ago, but the scale of this event was so vast that it cannot be erased from the memory of justice-seeking people around the world. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media for further details. Stay tuned for more. Tasnim News Agency wrote, the 40th anniversary of Sabra and Shatila massacre by the Zionist regime was marked by Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman Kanani. In a post on Instagram, the Iranian diplomat stressed that the apartheid Zionist regime, which was established on the basis of aggression, crimes, and blatant violations of international law and human rights, continues to pose a threat to world peace and security. September 16th marks the anniversary of the 3 days of crimes that resulted in an atrocious and inconceivable slaughter of Palestinian refugees at the Sabra and Shatila refugee camps in southern Beirut at the hands of the Zionist regime and its accomplices, which wasn't the false regime's first or final crime either. It was one of the most harrowing massacres committed in the Lebanese Civil War, a conflict known for its brutality. Shatila, a Palestinian refugee camp, and the adjacent neighborhood of Sabra are located southwest of Lebanon's capital city, Beirut. The refugees were victims of the 1948 Nakba, or catastrophe in Arabic, fleeing the violent ethnic cleansing of Palestine by Zionist militias as Israel was formed. But between September 16th and 18th, 1982, the refugees now living in Shatila and Sabra, along with Lebanese civilians, were attacked by a right-wing Lebanese militia in coordination with the Zionist regime army. Between 2,000 and 3,500 people were killed. Middle East Eye also wrote, the month of September has come to represent a series of historical devastations for the Palestinian people and their struggle. Commemoration of the sharp betrayals and travesties contained within these short 4 weeks is a painful ritual through which Palestinians reflect upon the continuing need for liberation. Moreover, it is a time to consider various ways freedom has continued to be denied and sabotaged by settler, colonial, and imperial violence of the Zionist regime. As if this weren't staggering enough, September 16th to 18th also marks the 40th anniversary of Sabra and Shatila massacre. The massacre was supported by the Zionist regime occupation forces, which had invaded and occupied Lebanon in an attempt to drive out the Palestinian resistance, and carried out with the full knowledge and intentional inaction of the United States. The ensuing bloodbath came on the heels of the U.S. imperialist Reagan Plan, a policy by which Washington dismissed the need for Palestinian statehood in favor of successful normalization with Israel, as central to fulfilling UN Security Resolution 242, and demanded that Jordan speak on behalf of the Palestinians in negotiations. This cruel juxtaposition reveals the overlap between the physical brutality of colonial murder and the political disempowerment that oppressive forces like the settler colonial U.S. apply to the global South in pursuance of geo-imperial domination. Following the massacre, the Zionist regime occupation authorities released the Kahan Commission report, which, as Palestinian intellectual Stephen Salaita argues, followed a larger pattern of colonial self-acquittal. Notably, the Kahan Commission report was celebrated by liberal imperialist corporate media outlets like New York Times. The legacy of Sabra and Shatila, in which victims were killed with impunity, remains four decades later, mirrored by what Israeli regime colonial authorities did after occupation forces assassinated Palestinian reporter Shirin Abu Aghele. U.S. President Joe Biden couldn't even be bothered to learn how to pronounce her name properly. But as reflected in the work of Robert Fisk, the Sabra and Shatila massacre also galvanized a new oppositional journalistic ethos that challenged the Zionist use of terrorism as a pretext for mass slaughter and false accusations of anti-Semitism against those defending Palestinian and Lebanese people murdered by local fascists with the help of Israeli regime occupation forces and a U.S. seal of approval. The total death toll is presumed to be anywhere from 800 to 2,000 Palestinians and at least 100 Lebanese. However, as historian Rashid Khalidi notes, because the Lebanese forces abducted many people who were never found, the complete number of victims may never be fully known. In the aftermath of Sabra and Shatila, journalists, for the first time, could directly transmit the horrors they confronted on the ground without pressure from their employers. It is, in this sense, that the massacre created a shift in how reporters and activists challenge the dominant narrative on Palestine. Today, Palestinians are able to bypass mainstream outlets and call attention to Zionist violence through social media, as we saw in May 2021, when activists in Sheikh Jarrah shared their stories and struggles with the world. Though Silicon Valley tech giants insidiously continue to practice digital apartheid against Palestinians, no amount of deletions can ever take away what the world has already seen.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Basing country issues on others is wrong. Pay attention to the domestic capacities. This is the part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the president and members of the cabinet in Imam Khomeini's Husseiniyah on August 30th, 2022. Another of your achievements has been your employing the youth in the country's executive sectors. This is a great move, for it opens the worn-out circle of managers, replacing them with a new force. This breathes new life into the country's executive bodies. This is a fantastic thing that's happened. Continue with it. I must also add, though, that I understand and have observed that previously, when I constantly talk about the youth, I knew that they too might make mistakes in certain cases. In both the administration and in the parliament, young people do make mistakes. But the benefits outweighs the cost of these mistakes. It is worth preserving the executive and legislative bodies of the countries being governed by youthful spirits instead of worrying about a few mistakes that might make in certain cases. By the will of God, these mistakes will gradually be resolved. This will result in good, strong leaders. This was another of your accomplishments.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Another great achievement this administration has made is that it has brought our society out of a state of expectation. It has turned people gaze away from foreigners. It has came out of these states of continuous waiting to see what others have to say about us, or what they will decide for us, or what they are going to do. Importance has been given to domestic capacities. Reliance has been placed on these, and work is being done. Some people say we should definitely have relations with a certain country in order to solve our problems. But this is very harmful to our country. Relying on others and waiting for them to solve the country's issues is the wrong approach. Thankfully, such a thing has been minimized to a great extent in your administration.
You've done for me through all my years.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Free pigeons for a world free of war. Iran's War University hosted the director of the United Nations Information Center in Iran, Inger Marie Venise, along with military attachés from different embassies, to attend this ceremony dubbed the Book of Peace and Defense, which is themed with the 1980s Iran-Iraq War. The UNIC head read out a statement from United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres during the event.
A time to observe 24 hours of non-violence and ceasefire, we renew our call for all people to do more than lay down their weapons.
This event comes on the occasion of the National Sacred Defense Week, which marks the beginning of the 1980 to 1988 Iran-Iraq War, the longest armed conflict of the 20th century, which was waged by the then Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein and heavily funded by the West. Every year on the occasion, the Islamic Republic holds nationwide ceremonies to highlight its resistance against the Iraqi forces.
At that time, the Ba'athist regime, and on top of it, Saddam Hussein, was fully supported by numerous Western countries. The war continued for 8 years, but we fought the invaders and did not give an inch of our soil to them. So today, we as veterans feel bound to transfer our expertise and tactics to the new generation to preserve our defense might.
Saddam Hussein failed to make any achievement in his war against Iran, but the humanitarian effects of the offensive are still lingering in Iran, with many war veterans continuing to reel from exposure to chemical substances used by Iraqi forces. Those chemical materials were reportedly supplied by a number of German, French, and Dutch corporations.
The Islamic Republic takes great pride in how it defended the country during the Iraqi imposed war, calling it the sacred defense and a drive for its present self-sufficiency in the military sector. Meanwhile, Tehran holds this annual commemoration ceremony as a chance to promote peace and shed light on the dark consequences of war. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Amid international calls for renewing the UN brokered truce, the Yemeni Center for Human Rights has held a press conference in Sana'a to release a report titled The Alleged Truce. The report highlights the Saudi-led coalition's violations of the UN agreement since it was brokered in April.
Saudi Arabia's violations were committed from the first day of the war, but they continued even under the UN truce. The most important violations were the non-compliance with the terms of the truce, which included reducing the number of scheduled flights and specifying only one destination instead of two, as well as the continued detention of fuel ships. There is a breach on the essence of the agreement.
The report says the Saudi-led coalition has committed over 14,000 violations, including waging 278 airstrikes, which led to the death of Yemeni civilians.
As a human rights center, we affirm that the most important violations are the loss of life. Unfortunately, during the truce, 70 Yemeni civilians, including women and children, were killed. The siege has also continued during the truce. This has caused the deaths of thousands of civilians due to the lack of fuel in hospitals.
Recently, the UN Security Council urged warring sites in Yemen to extend the truce, saying it has had tangible benefits for the humanitarian situation in the war-torn country. So far, there are no signs of agreement from both parties.
A complete end to the war and siege is what Yemenis are demanding from the international community, including the United Nations. They say the temporary truce should not be extended since the world body has failed to ensure its full implementation. Al-Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
British police have found themselves in